You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
It's really wonderful to have all of you here, and I think we'll have a very lively and interesting discussion, thanks to a truly fantastic panel. I'm so grateful for the panelists to have agreed to join us. And the timing is pretty good, you know, about a little more than a week after the European parliamentary elections, in the middle of this debate that has erupted on the presidency of the Commission and many other topics to cover. We have Isabel Kumar, who has the flagship program, the Global Conversation for Euronews. Isabel came all the way from London yesterday. Lyon. I'm sorry. Absolutely. From Paris. And Lyon in Paris. That's right. I'm sorry. I made a mistake. And Isabel, for those of you who watched her, but maybe not everybody had a chance to, moderated the first Spitzenkandidaten, you know, European presidential debate. Although if I say that, I know Peter and others may say, what is Kemal saying? Presidential debate. But anyway, let's call it presidential debate in shorthand, and of course we'll discuss why that is. And I watched it, and I was really impressed by the moderation. So we invited her, and she was gracious to accept. Reza Mogadam, many of you know, he's the Department Director for Europe at the IMF. He was before that the director for the Strategy and Policy Department. I don't think I exaggerate or in any way in saying that he is one of the top economists in the world, top people at the IMF, and there are few people, I think, who have as deep a knowledge about the European economy and the challenges ahead for Europe than Reza. I had the pleasure and sometimes the tough time to negotiate with him when he was chief of mission for the IMF and I was on the Turkish government side, but that was quite some time ago. There's my co-editor, Jacques Mistral. We have our book out there for those of you who want to get it later on. It's out in front of the door. Jacques is a French economist, a non-resident senior fellow at Brookings. He's very modest, so I kept arguing with him what I could put, you know, in terms of description on the handouts. He was senior advisor to the reformist French Prime Minister Michel Rocard. He was chief economist at the AXA Group, so he has both private sector and public sector experience. And he is one of the key organizers of the annual Cercle des Economistes meeting, which meets in Aix every year and brings together economists from around the world. Then we have two very dear friends, the Ambassador of Ireland and the Ambassador of the United Kingdom. Anne Anderson, I didn't check on every single position she's had, but she seems to have gotten all the important positions in her life. Among them, of course, Ambassador to France, but of course to Brussels, to the EU, so she's extremely knowledgeable about EU affairs. And to the UN, too. So global affairs and now to Washington. And she reminded me that she also had to negotiate, but much more recently, with Reza Mogadam on the Irish program. But that was when Ireland was already doing pretty well. And Sir Peter Westmacott, previously ambassador in France, in Turkey, where we became friends, now in Washington. I don't think I can exaggerate one of the top figures of British and European diplomacy, and really also a dear friend. Thanks for being here, Peter. And I tend to hire some of his staff when we lose people. I draw on the British Embassy staff. So thanks a lot for being here. I think the degree to which the debate has erupted over who should lead the Commission president is somewhat surprising to a lot of people. I mean, we knew that it was going to be a debate. There would be some horse trading, some negotiations. But I think it has become very serious. And so I think this will be one of the topics we have to address. Not just in itself. I don't think the debate is all about the personality of Jean-Claude Juncker, who has, of course, a lot of experience for sure, but who some say is a little bit representing the past of Europe, not necessarily the future. But, you know, there is a whole current of thought and of belief now that you cannot have a EU election like we had it. We cannot have Isabel moderating these people. And, of course, I'll ask her what she thinks about it. You know, in the first ever, really, historical post, beyond borders political debate. I mean, I don't think there ever has been a debate like that. And then, you know, and then somebody wins. And then you say, well, you know, that's very nice. It was kind of entertaining. But now let's get down to serious business and choose the candidate and leaders of the countries. It's going to be difficult. I don't know what will happen in the end, but I think there is a strong enough view that this shouldn't be the case and that the election should be taken seriously. And one sign of that is that all the center parties, the kind of mainstream parties, not the populists of the extreme right or extreme left, but the liberals, the center right, of course, which won, the center left, the Greens, have all rallied behind Juncker. So that, you know, it's not just that it's the center right that's supporting him, it's the whole moderate spectrum. Maybe not Matt Brown, but I don't know, we'll find out. From the Center of American Progress. He's another one of the leading, you know, people debating this in Europe. So, on the other hand, there is the view that, and that was expressed today by Gideon Rahman in the Financial Times, I just read it out to you very briefly. It is above all in nations with their shared ties of language, history, and political culture that democracy can live and breathe. At a European level, you cannot replicate the forms of democracy, elections, political parties, and so on. Sorry, you can replicate the forms of democracy, but what you cannot create is the underlying demos, the people that is needed to bind democracy together. And then he rubs it in even further. That is why you end up with the absurd situation in which voters are said to have chosen a leader they have never heard of. So you see, there are really two very, very different positions, and I think this is one of the really key topics ahead of us for the European institutions. Now, I think behind that, there's also the whole issue of the future of the Eurozone. And of course, as an economist and as the director of the Global Economics and Development Program, you know, we're very interested in that. There's the view among most economists. I think most economists that I know, if I've interacted with, believe, and a lot of the U.S. economists actually, you know, believe, that you cannot have a monetary union without having a much further degree of fiscal policy coordination, banking union, banking supervision, and therefore not necessarily political federalism, but something that comes quite close to a pretty high degree of political federalism if you want to have a monetary union. Now, of course, not all of Europe is in the monetary union, but if that is true, can you achieve that coordination at the technical economic policy level without having a corresponding democratic space? And I think a lot of the debate revolves around that. Not everybody agrees that you need that degree of policy coordination, and I hope Reza will give his opinion particularly on how much policy coordination is needed. But I would say a large majority of economists do believe that. And then that has some consequences, some political consequences, which are hard to face, but which don't go away. And I think that perhaps is the deeper dimension of the debate we're experiencing around the head of the Commission. So with that, let me turn to Anne Anderson first. Anne, what lessons do you take from the elections? How do you look at the path forward, the European institutions? Anything you want to share with us as a start, we'll then have an interactive discussion. But if you had to focus on two or three main points, what would they be?
Okay, Kamal, thank you for a very challenging introduction. Certainly, it's been a very sobering election outcome. There's no question about that. Maybe to make a few points about the outcome. Firstly, I think participation rates were disappointing, in line with previous participation in European elections. But still, when you have 43% voting, 57% of people staying at home, that points to a certain disconnect and apathy, which is a cause for concern. Secondly, I think we can't forget that, in a way, there were 28 separate messages here. because we have 28 member states, and as you always find in European elections, people are addressing their national governments at least as much as they're sending a message to Brussels. But thirdly, and I think we have to recognise this, insofar as there was a European-wide message, obviously what all the headlines have focused on is the 30% of the vote that went to the Eurosceptic and populist parties and candidates. And that's a jolt, certainly. I think there always has to be concern when a climate is created in which extreme views are taking more of the space. So I think that certainly is food for very serious thought. Another point I would make is in terms of the how it's looked at from across the Atlantic here. I think there's no question but that you know Europe is still going to be very much a strong functioning partner for the United States, and worries about TTIP being derailed and so on I think are out of place. But I do think there's something important to be said about the message that came from this 30%, because it's something we have to face together in Europe and the United States, because fundamentally I think this was a message about fear of globalization, that there is really no question but that, you know, Europe is not the enemy. Europe is really not the target. Europe is a lightning rod for a lot of this discontent. People feel buffeted by globalization. They feel that they're at the mercy of forces that they can't control. And obviously the United States is not immune to that either. You see the way those concerns are playing out among sectors of the population here. So I think it's something that's important transatlantically that we take account of. I think in terms of what it's going to mean in Europe, it's clear that the leaders have already said it can't be business as usual. We're going to see some policy adjustments. This has been a vote really about the economy and about growth and jobs, about austerity fatigue, and the European leaders are going to have to take that into account. And of course the challenge is, how do you keep the necessary fiscal disciplines and at the same time at least soften the edges of austerity? I think there are going to be issues about the way we do business, what we do and how we do it in Europe. More relevance, less red tape. And I think that question that's been around for so long about how do we communicate Europe to our citizens, that message comes into even sharper focus. In terms of what happens in the institutions, let's see how things play out in the European Parliament. This 30% of the populist Eurosceptic vote, if I can shorthand it that way, it's actually a very fractured vote, fractured between right and left, and you see the difficulties the right are already having in trying to create alliances between themselves. The 70% of the centrist parties will certainly be incentivized to work even more closely together. So let's wait and see just what impact this 30% has. In terms of the, and I'd finish with this, the question that you raised about the president of the Commission, I'm not going to get into individuals and personalities. The arguments, as you lay them out, are there on both sides. But I do think that this result is going to make the European leaders look ultimately even more carefully at the qualities that they're going to require in whoever takes over this key role, who's going to be able to implement and the kind of policies that are going to be there, who's going to be able to articulate a vision that has resonance for people in Europe, who's the skilled communicator, which we clearly need. So I think in the ultimate decision, we're going to see people looking at those questions again and seeing who best ticks those boxes. So
thank you. I really hope you're right on the last one. It's so important. Isabel, you moderated that debate. And of course, you're, as you reminded me, in Lyon, in the heart of Europe, continental Europe. But on the debate, how did you live it? I mean, what impact did it have on your perception, and how did you follow the kind of campaign in Europe? Was it an important campaign, or was it just a campaign restricted to a, you know, very small minority of European citizens?
Well, I think, as Anne said, there's 28 different campaigns going on, so it's quite difficult to follow all those campaigns. But I think the one that grabbed most people's attention, well, the two, was the campaigns in France and the campaign in Britain, where you have UKIP and the Front National, where everybody was expecting them to make such big gains, and they did. In terms of the debate was terribly exciting and tense. And I think those are two words I think have never been used together to describe a European election, because for the first time you had these candidates in front of you representing Europe, and they had to make their case for Europe, but they also had to make themselves known. And our starting point when we had this debate wasn't let's try and kind of eke out what different policies they've got, because in many respects these guys are very similar. It was more, nobody knows who the hell they are. You know, let's actually just try and present them to our viewers, and so people actually can identify who on earth Jean-Claude Juncker is, who Martin Schulz is, Scar Keller. I don't think anybody had even heard of Scar Keller, who's one of the leaders of the Green Party, and Guy Verhofstadt. So that's what was very exciting about this, and it also was brought home some truths that really Europeans don't know who they are, and they aren't that interesting. Again, it comes back to what Anne was saying. 43.1% of the electorate voted. So whereas as a journalist, I found it very exciting, I think generally people are feeling quite apathetic about Europe. And so therefore, even though we have this great, you know, not great, but this interesting backdrop of the rise of Euroscepticism, we have the economy in so much trouble, people actually couldn't be bothered to vote. So the debates were great. Did they fire up interest? The jury's out on that one. And so, you know, I think the Eurovision Song Contest was probably followed more closely than the European elections.
Thank you. But just as a matter of statistics, the participation in the U.S. congressional election, both the presidential year and the off year, averages to about the same as the European parliamentary election. And the year when there's not a presidential election, actually the participation in the U.S. Congress is less. So when we say that 43% is not very impressive, you know,
but this time
more,
it was billed, it was going to be different.
Still a pretty, you know.
It's okay, but then do you have to judge yourself by, well, I wouldn't say the lowest common denominator, but if you're setting the target high, surely you want to kind of beat your past result by more than 0.1%, especially when you have these kind of candidates standing there, you know, who are meant to kind of fire interest in Europe.
I agree. I'd be very careful before I debate you, Isabel.
But also the rates in national elections in Europe are much higher than in the domestic election here.
That is true. It's a more politicized society some degree. Jacques, and I'll come back to all of you later, and particularly on the economic side, but bringing the topic a little more also onto the economic side, and, you know, Europe, after all, has gone through not all countries have gone through a very serious crisis, although even Germany in 2009 had a negative 5% or something like that growth rate. But is there now an economic recovery? How is the economics perceived, and how can you link the economic arguments to the debate?
Thank you, Kemal. In effect, the Eurozone went through a chaotic debt crisis for 2 years. The critical question that has made for too long a euro breakdown a plausible possibility was, if I may say, as simple as that. Are the Eurozone member countries willing to stick together at all price? At all price? That's a politically terrifying question. And it took 2 years of intense and political debates to offer a credible and positive answer. The European Council in June 2012 confirmed the unanimous adhesion to the monetary union and designed policy and institutional changes to make it properly function in the future. ECB President Mario Draghi, as you know, later translated this political decision into intelligible words. We will do whatever it takes. The Eurozone has now exited the financial danger zone and is moving towards a stronger integration. The result will not be perfect, but my guess is that it will work. On the other side, the crisis has dramatic consequences. Unemployment has skyrocketed in the south, and social conditions have deteriorated. And the European elections, unsurprisingly, are proof of many frustrations. But frustrations against what? Against excessive immigration? Possibly. Against Hollande in France? Certainly. Against austerity in Greece? Definitely. Adhesion to the European ideal has been battered by the development of a dual Europe between a prosperous North and a depressed South. But interestingly enough, two-thirds of the populace everywhere want to keep the euro. Two-thirds in Greece, in Spain, in France, in Germany, among others. Now, what is the political answer to these political feelings? First, the newly elected European Parliament is no expression of a Eurosceptic Union. On the contrary, Eurocritics will have a louder voice in Brussels, okay, but they are divided, and let me be blunt but clear, they will prove much less influential than, say, the Tea Party in Washington. Much more important, in my view, is the vibrant and unexpected European democratic exercise we are witnessing at about the choice of the president of the Commission. The pro-European parties have unanimously agreed on the name of the Parliament's candidate, Mr. Juncker. This approach had been explicitly sold to the voters. Not respecting it now would appear close to electoral fraud, in Mr. Schulz's words. My guess is that at the end, the Parliament will be and will feel empowered, and this will prove a watershed in European politics. In short, voters have sent to Brussels a wide pro-European majority, and this Parliament will exercise traction towards a more integrated Eurozone that is definitely needed. The pro-European parties, from the centre-right, from the centre-left, the Greens and the Liberals, represent the diversity of European constituencies. And they should work across the aisle, like in Washington in the past, and not build, as it has been sometimes suggested, not build an explicit transnational grand coalition like in Germany. This strategy would reinforce the perception of an elite cartel which runs the EU to the detriment of many Europeans. And that would precisely fuel the Eurosceptic narrative of a dispute between the elites and the people. Finally, policy debates in Brussels must now on be focused on pragmatic responses to the challenges facing the Union and the Member States, mostly employment and protection. The major goal is to combine fiscal convergence, that is good underway, and to design a successful growth-oriented policy mix. Challenges are daunting, but the latest news from Brussels are clear. The Eurozone is moving forward.
Thank you, Jacques, and but that was a very optimistic and forceful message. I do want to share with you that even I was sometimes worried about Grexit. I didn't believe it would happen, mainly for political reasons. But while I would say a large majority of professional opinion in Washington was convinced that Greece would exit the euro, Jacques steadfastly defended the view that it would not. So I just want to put that on record. Reza, you're responsible for a lot of this stuff. director of the IMF Europe Department. Can you tell us just a few words on the economy? In particular, how do you link this populist, yes, it's not a majority, but 30% is a large vote. How much of it is economic distress, unemployment? And also, deflation now. The European inflation target is 2% or just below. It's now running at less than half. All hell would break loose if inflation was 3.5%. Right? I mean, think about it. Everybody would be now. It's below 1%, almost getting close to zero, and nothing seems to be happening.
Thanks, Kimmel, and thanks for the kind introductions. I think before I come to the inflation story, I think let me just endorse what you implicitly and Jacques explicitly mentioned, that the turnaround in sentiments, market sentiments in particular, over the last 2 years is really remarkable. And I would add one other dimension, again, to add perspective. If you look at the European project as an economic integration and economic performance project over the last 50 years, there is considerable success. I think it's a major success story, particularly this year is the 10th anniversary of the new member states joining the European Union. It's the 25th anniversary of the fall of Berlin Wall. And if you take that perspective of integrating particularly Eastern Europe or raising living standards in core Europe over the past 50 years, I think the European story is a major global success. But having said that, let me now come to my normal job. I think the challenge, what you mentioned, the relationship between economic distress and what you see in opinion polls and what is translated into election results is very striking usually. And at the heart of it at the moment is the challenge of jobs and growth, what Anne mentioned earlier. I think that is at the heart of the problems faced by Europe and the unacceptable high levels of unemployment. And the question is, I think, moving forward, how to address that, because from a political, social perspective, I think it is, again, remarkable over the last 3 years, 4 years of economic stress that we have seen, although there is a lot of hardship, we have not seen the sort of social strife that we see, for instance, in emerging market crises, or we have seen earlier episodes of crisis in the world. So, but the sustainability of that requires job creation. It requires reducing unemployment. And I think what Jack mentioned earlier, European economies, many of them, have very high debt. And as you mentioned, inflation is incredibly low. When inflation is low, it's difficult to bring debt down. When debt is high, growth suffers. And so I think number one challenge, this issue of growth and inflation are related, is short-term support through economic policies to increase growth in the short run. There is also a long-run problem. I'll come back to that. But I think we have been advocating that there is need for supportive macro policies. Given the high level of debt, fiscal policy at least has to do no harm. And from this year onward, the stance of fiscal policy in Europe is neutral. So a big burden is on monetary policy. And I think our view has been there is room for conventional and unconventional monetary policy easing in Europe, and it is indeed necessary to create the room for reforms that increase potential growth later. We need short-term growth to come back to provide that space. So we think there is that need. It is encouraging that ECB is talking about action this week, and one hopes that there is...
They're meeting on Thursday, right?
They're meeting this Thursday. They are talking that they will act, and certainly in light of the recent growth and inflation numbers, it is necessary to act. But there is also a long-term issue. We calculate that right now, potential output, what the European economies are capable of growing on average in the Eurozone, is only 0.5%. 0.5% is hardly adequate to stabilize, let alone reduce unemployment. That rate of growth needs to be brought up. And that requires, and this is where the election results are a complication, one fears that they may stand in the way of needed reform, particularly labor and product market reform. So, but on the other hand, it is necessary for the growth to come back to undertake those reforms. I would also say there are two other areas where it is necessary at a European level to move. In the US, as many of you know, the reliance on bank credit is much lower than it is in Europe. In Europe, the capital markets are not as much developed. Corporates rarely go to the capital markets. They have to rely on the banking system. The banking systems are weak. They are being assessed in order to strengthen them, but they are weak. Credit is still falling. So developing capital markets in Europe, I think, is an urgent task to increase that availability of credit and potential growth in the long run. And the other point I want to say is an issue we are currently discussing with our European colleagues in the context of our annual consultation is that the current fiscal framework in Europe, the governance of it, is worth looking at. The current fiscal framework is based on a framework which is based on targets for deficits, targets for structural deficits. But when you have different levels of debt across Europe, some very high debt, some lower debt, the same kind of targets do not make sense across. And as I told you at the beginning, given that debt is at the heart of the debt overhang, not just the private, not just the public sector, but also private sector, you need to have mechanisms that look at debt and how to bring them down rather than simply on fiscal bottom line. Thank you.
Stocks rather than flows, or stocks complementing flows, I guess, right? Peter, your take on the latest events, and let me ask you a more pointed question. I remember David Cameron's very important speech, I think it was in January, a year and a half, you know, Europe speech, which he originally wanted to give, I think, in Netherlands, but then ended up giving in London. It was a speech that was awaited, and he gave a very, he gave a strong view on his perspective in Europe. And one thing that I was almost surprised by in that speech was the emphasis he put as a British Prime Minister on the need for the Eurozone to coordinate and to integrate further in order to manage the euro. That was, of course, when the euro crisis was still in full swing. Okay? As opposed, for example, to the Swedish Prime Minister, Finance Minister, who a few weeks later said the opposite, saying that, in fact, if the Eurozone integrated further, that could be the end of the European Union. That was not at all the British Prime Minister's view on the Eurozone. At the same time, it's quite clear that the UK will not join the Eurozone in the foreseeable future, and that the British Prime Minister, as well as the British political leadership as a whole, not everybody, is quite fiercely opposed to further federalization or political integration in Europe. So when you take these two things, on the one hand, yes, the Eurozone has to integrate more, and we've heard both, I think, Reza and Jacques putting forward arguments in that direction, with the statement that, of course, the UK will never be part of that. What does it mean for the future of Europe and for the future of Europe where, you know, the UK is part of it, and for many other reasons, I think, so many good reasons for why it should be part of it. But on that particular point, how are these two statements compatible?
Thank you, Kamal, for nice, easy questions. And thanks for giving us the chance to join your panel. I won't cover all the stuff that Anne said, which I entirely agree about the consequences of the elections and what it means about State of Europe. I just perhaps underline a couple of points. First of all, I think the rise of Eurosceptic parties in a number of countries, not least mine, but also in France and Greece and a number of others, is a very significant development. There is one sense in which this is a traditional kind of protest vote. My Foreign Secretary, William Hague, called it a kind of free vote where you can give the government of the day good kicking. And you would normally expect that at a time when the economy is difficult and you're struggling to recover from a recession and so on. But it also conveys a broader message. And as David Cameron, my Prime Minister, said just before the last informal European Council, we can't just shrug off these results and carry on as if nothing had happened. We've got to focus on what this means. We need a new approach which recognizes that Europe is defective in addressing the needs of people, of electors, and that it's got to focus a bit more on jobs and growth and making the European Union work better. And it wasn't only David Cameron who reached that conclusion. I mean, the President of France, for example, said that the European Union had become, I jotted down a couple of his words, Europe's become unreadable, distant, incomprehensible, even for member states. This can't go on. And he made a point which David Cameron has made on a number of occasions about what we call in the jargon subsidiarity, that is to say allowing member states to do what they should be doing and allow Europe to do what Europe should be doing, and which is better done at that level rather than at nation-state level. And President Hollande also said, we need Europe to be simple and clear, to be effective where it's expected to be, and withdraw from areas where it is not necessary. And I think, you know, that's an indication also of the sort of reactions that there was amongst political leaders. The Italian Prime Minister, Mr. Renzi, says the answer is better Europe, not more Europe, as a reaction to these elections. So I think it's a bit of a wake-up call for a number of European governments, and it is an indication that Europe needs to prepare itself better for the future, to be more responsive, more democratically accountable, more flexible, more focused on competitiveness, doing the job better, if you like, rather than just sticking with what many people would regard now as a somewhat out-of-date federalist integrationist agenda. And that, I think, is the attitude which conditions certainly the attitude of my government towards the appointments that need to be made in the coming months for the future leaders of the European Union's institutions. We need people who are focused on the future, who can rise to those challenges, who can make Europe work better, respond to the messages from public opinion, rather than, if you like, stuck in the past and business as usual. Your second question, how do we reconcile these two different messages which come from the UK? Well, of course, they are entirely consistent, as always, in messages that come from my government. I think there were two points that the Prime Minister was making. First of all, we have as much interest in the Eurozone succeeding as any member of the Eurozone, of the currency union. We may not be a member of it. We have decided that we do not wish to be a member of the currency union, along with another 10 or 11 member states. But half of the United Kingdom's foreign trade is with other members of the Eurozone, or with the members of the Eurozone. About 60% is with other members of the European Union. We need it to succeed. It gives us no satisfaction at all, except when we're dealing with people who told us we got everything wrong, to have a growth rate this year of 3.1%, according to the IMF, whereas the European average is down at 1.2, 1.3, and unemployment rates are a great deal higher in many members of the Eurozone. We have every interest in the Eurozone solving its problems and getting on with it. And we recognize that if you are going to deal with the problems that come with having a currency union but without having fiscal or monetary union, that the Eurozone needs to be strengthened, and we will give our support to that in whatever way that needs to be done. So that's where the Prime Minister was coming from. Doesn't mean to say that we are going to join tomorrow. As you rightly said, the United Kingdom is not likely to join the Eurozone tomorrow. We have to continue dealing with our own economic difficulties like everybody else has to. We dropped very deep. We went into a deep hole. Our annual deficit, public finances, went up to almost 12% in the aftermath of the financial meltdown in 2008. We've managed to halve that since then, at the same time as having restored our level of growth from a time only about 18 months ago when we feared we might have had a triple dip recession, though the numbers got adjusted afterwards, to having what is now, as I mentioned, the highest growth rate in the G7. So we're feeling that it's going in the right direction. Deficit is down, unemployment record low, more people in work than ever before, and with growth rates which are much better than the average. But it is still fragile, and we want to move ahead with that. We attach enormous importance to the European Union continuing to reform itself, completing the single market, becoming more competitive, so it is a more attractive place for foreign direct investment, so that our enterprises are better able to compete in the world's economy. All that relates to the needs of all 28 of us, not just to the Eurozone. Eurozone, we want it to succeed, we'll support it in any way that we can, that we need to, and if that means changing the rules of the game and strengthening the Eurozone, that's fine by us. But equally, not least because we are part of it, we want the Europe of 28 to succeed too.
Excellent. Well, I must say, very, very impressive statement of the UK position. And thank you, Peter. And that was very, very articulate. And I think that in many ways that many of us who hope for a strong European Union also to partner the US, I mean, that kind of vision is, if it works, would be great. Just two more things, and then I will open to the floor. There's one is the, if anybody wants to say something about the US EU relationship, you know, in a broader context, what it, I mean, of course, there's TTIP, and you mentioned it, but will it be harder with this parliament? To what degree will it be harder? Maybe, Anne, you want to say something about that, or anybody else? And then the other thing I wanted to ask is Matteo Renzi. I mean, if there was one person that came out hugely successful from these elections, it's the Italian prime minister. I mean, no, you know, the his party, I think, is now going to have the second largest group in the European Parliament. Nobody has had that kind of percentage victory for decades. And the center-right opposition, the difference in percentage points, 25 percentage point difference. And he gives a message in jeans and shirt that, you know, Peter, you quoted part of it by saying better Europe, not necessarily more. He also clearly says less austerity, but more reform. So any comments? Because it is an extraordinary, I think, victory. I mean, you know, how long-lasting it will be, we'll see. But I don't think one can comment on the last few weeks without noting this really very impressive performance of a young center-left politician. And I'm sure that Jacques, I don't know what you think, but Manuel Valls would love to be in his place.
Well, we see the benefits of having a prime minister like Matteo Renzi with a vision, with decisiveness, and that brings votes election on election day. In France, probably the political situation during the last first years of President Hollande was on the opposite track. Is he able to reverse the movement through Valls only? I don't think so, because the Fifth Republic is made in order to allow the president to remain the boss. What can happen is when and if Valls, for example, was able to find some personal room of maneuver and sketch a political character like Matteo Renzi, that's not unfeasible. In that case, he becomes indispensable to the president, and he gets much more power by threatening to resign, because this would mean the end of the vice presidency. So we are in this position. We don't know, because Valls has only 2 months and has already one electoral defeat. So we will see.
Thank you. Isabel, I mean, you're watching all this politics. How do you sense the Renzi phenomenon, the 41% of the vote, which is huge?
Well, I suppose in some respects, if you look at Italian politics, I think Beppe Grillo is slightly old hat, and I think he lost a lot of people's support because he's been derided in the press a lot. What he says doesn't really stand up, and it's not particularly constructive. So Italians are really searching for somebody to support, and in came Matteo Renzi. He's obviously a very astute politician, and he did very well in Florence, but he hasn't got a great deal of experience. And we'll have to see how he builds up all these policies that he's stating he will and whether he'll be capable of doing it. And then the other thing is the Italian electorate is fickle. And so you'll have to see what and who they throw their support behind next.
Yeah. Reza, less austerity, more reform? What has he done? What do you think he can do?
I think
he gave a 1,000 euro tax rebate to lower-income families as a first step.
I think the fact remains that Italy has major challenges forward. The debt is extremely high. A quarter of the Eurozone debt is in Italy. The financing of that on a weekly basis is a major challenge. So maintaining market access would be extremely important. He has to run, because of his high debt, he has to run a sizable primary surplus, and one which they have been successful in recent years, but not as high as they had planned to do. And the reform agenda, the potential growth in Italy is extremely low. So the reform agenda to increase that potential growth has to encompass both labour market reforms, which are extremely difficult to deliver given the constituency of the Prime Minister, and services reform, which in Italy lacks lags other countries, for instance, Spain. So he needs the support and he needs the political backing to be able to deliver a very, very challenging agenda. So we are only at the beginning of the road in that.
Peter?
Just a brief comment on that. Less austerity, more reform. I think it depends what you mean by austerity. In our case, we didn't have a choice but to apply austerity to our public finances because, as I was saying, the debt had got to a very, very high level. And if we hadn't taken visible action to reassure the markets, our borrowing costs would have gone through the roof. We're not part of the Eurozone. We don't have the dollar as a reserve currency. So the markets were going to watch very carefully what we had to do. So we felt that we had to do that. But at the same time, what we did was try to balance that policy of getting public finances under control and bringing down public debt with an expansive policy in terms of more pro-business policies, encouraging foreign investment, encouraging the private sector to get going. Since the present British government came to power in 2010, we have created more than 2 million jobs in the private sector, and we have shed 600,000 in the public sector. So we've tried to move the growth towards the private sector and take away the requirement on the public sector, on the government and the taxpayer, to put too much money into the stimulus packages. So I think when you talk about less austerity, I think you need to look at the economy as a whole and see where there are areas where you need to do austerity and where there are other areas where you can balance austerity in the public sector with a more expansive policy, encouraging the private sector to take up the slack. We haven't yet got enough credit from the banks yet. We would like to see more a role of the financial sector in promoting growth than we've got at the moment, but I think it's going in the right direction. And the second thing I would just add is that as we look at reform, yes, I've said just now why I think the European Union needs to do much more in terms of reform. Matteo Renzi has spelled out what he thinks. That is how we're going to become more competitive. That's how we're going to deal with some of the structural imbalances. And I put in a little plug for our friend TTIP at the same time. That is to say, more free trade between the European Union and the United States of America, half the world's GDP between us. That is going to help make a difference and to consolidate the recovery. And it's pretty well win-win. You know, that is where we can get additional growth, more jobs, and more trade in both directions across the Atlantic. And thank set global standards the others will have to follow.
And
yes, thank
on
you,
both, Kamal. On both points, if you
yes,
care
a number
to.
Of points. I mean, on austerity, growth, I don't think anyone is better placed to talk about austerity, perhaps, than we in Ireland, because during the tough years for us in our programme, we took about 18% out of our GDP through a combination of cutbacks in public expenditure and additional taxes. And we see the benefits. The economy really is winning through, and we haven't got time to take you through all the commercials for how well Ireland is doing, but there's no question that that we're coming through in good shape. But we saw it in our election results that the austerity fatigue is clearly there. And despite all the positive indicators, employment creation, growth creation, all of that, people sent a very clear message to the government that we need to soften the edges of this austerity. And I think you saw that message more widely across Europe. Now, you asked about the Italian Prime Minister, and, you know, again, I won't get into the details of every country. I think Isabel probably implicit in what she said was he was very lucky in his main opponent, perhaps the Italian Prime Minister. But just, you know, and Peter so rightly and quoted all of these elegant statements from all of these leaders, and they all go in the same direction. You know, we've got to be more intelligent, and I try to shorthand it by, you know, more relevance, less red tape, etc., etc. The real problem is that it's so easy to say these things, it's so tough to do it, because we have been saying this in Europe for so long. When I came as ambassador to as permanent representative in Brussels in 2001, what was in the air, the excitement of the Laeken Declaration and everything that followed that, the Constitutional Convention, it was exactly the same challenge we were trying to address. If you reread those texts, we've got to connect better, we've got to be more relevant, we've got to reach the citizen. You know, we wrote the script essentially back then, and we're still trying to actually find ways to do it that can bring all the member states along, that can resonate with our public. So, you know, there is no difficulty. We can all stand up and give the speeches and about ideally the way Europe needs to go forward, balancing this and balancing that and so on. But actually, the challenge for us to do it this time is what's so huge. On TTIP, I would let me re-echo Peter's plug on that. There may be some short-term complications, as there are here in the United States, obviously, because of the midterm elections on TTIP. We may see some little blips in Europe as well. But essentially, it's the response to that big question of how we try to channel globalization. And the US and Europe have huge responsibilities there, because a win-win TTIP that's fair and balanced and seen to be so is us kind of riding the tiger of globalization. And that's what's needed. And I think an intelligent, fair, balanced TTIP is part of the answer rather than the problem.
Thank you very much, Anne. I think we'll go now to a little bit of a question-answer mode. It will not be one question immediate answer, but a few points, and then, you know, we'll try to make it as interactive as possible. Ivan, I'll start with you. And could you please identify yourself so that everybody knows very briefly?
Ivan Vejvoda, Senior Vice President at the German Marshall Fund. Kemal and Brookings, thank you for organizing this excellent panel. Two questions. One is, one of the great successes of the European Union has been the enlargement. Heralded over these past years, as was mentioned, we're celebrating 10 years of the Big Bang. And the question is, what do these elections mean for the future of enlargement? Because we have, as one says in Washington, the unfinished business, especially in the Balkans, not to mention Turkey, of a core part of geographical Europe that is not yet integrated. Will we see bureaucracy with the conveyor belt of the enlargement process, because we're not expecting any new members until 2020? And will we, on the other hand, be hearing the member states saying no to enlargement because that's what the public wants to hear? Not unrelated to that is the second question, Ukraine. Has Ukraine been a wake-up call like the elections have been? Geopolitics, for many of us, we knew that it was never out. For some, they thought it was pushed to the side. Will this lead to a more concerted European foreign and security policy? Thank you.
Thank you. Doug? Then Miriam.
Thanks. And thank you, Kemal, for this great conference. Doug Redeker from the Peterson Institute for International Economics. I wanted to get into a more of a technical aspect, if I could, on the economics of this, which is the major initiative for Europe, certainly within the Eurozone this year, is banking union. And just a fairly straightforward but complicated question, I think, which is the motivation for banking union, in part, explicitly, was to address the so-called doom loop of the relationship between sovereigns and the banks that held their debt and this potential risk. And we don't hear much about that anymore. And in fact, I believe that banks now within the Eurozone own as much, if not more, sovereign debt than they did at the beginning of the crisis. So the question is a straightforward one, which is, under CRD4, sovereigns are treated as riskless assets. And under the ECB's new single supervisory mechanism, under the most recent note, they have now said that that is not the case, that sovereigns should be treated as risk-weighted assets. So a question, when you're addressing, within the context of banking union, this relationship between sovereigns and banks, are sovereigns riskless or not?
Thanks, Doug. Miriam? We'll take two more and then we'll turn.
Thank you, Kemal. Miriam Shapiro from Brookings. I wanted to come back to the leadership.
And former U.S. Deputy Trade Representative.
That's right.
People should know.
Yes, as of earlier this year. I wanted to come back to the leadership question that we started with, because I think it's critical for dealing with a whole host of challenges that both the U.S. and Europe and a lot of our other partners are facing. I mean, going into the election, it was anticipated that the far right and the far left would make gains, so I don't think the result was wholly unexpected. At the same time, the concern that I saw was not that we didn't know who was going to emerge as the likely candidate for the presidency, but that there was no consensus on how that person, he or she, would be chosen. And so member states have said, we can read the Lisbon Treaty, it's our decision to make. Members of parliament have said, no, it's the will of the people as expressed in the election. So to use Isabel's term, let's be constructive. What's the constructive way forward, and how soon do you think this question can be resolved so that we don't have a situation of a lame duck Commission. We don't have a president of the council or a foreign minister, Kathy Ashton's successor, to take terribly long. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I just want to add for information, that according to the new agreement or treaty, I'm always a little bit not quite clear of the dates, but yesterday I read a piece that says that the president of the commission, which was not the case before, actually had to also agree to the appointment of every commissioner. So in the past, it was the council appointing the president and the commissioners. Now the council appoints the president, of course, has a lot of influence when it gets nominated, but the president has the additional power of actually having to sign off on the command. Now, what that means in practice, we'll see. Yes, the last question for this round, and then we'll have a next round.
Stefan Grobe with Euronews in Washington. A short one on enlargement. What impact will a successful Scottish referendum have on Europe going forward?
What do you mean by successful?
Successful, well, in the eyes of the independence movement, of course.
Okay, by the way, from when Anne was talking about getting things done, it reminded me of Jean-Claude Juncker's rather well-known phrase, we all know what to do, but we don't know how to get elected to do it. Well, now he seems to kind of have gotten elected, but anyway, it was one of those famous sentences that went around last year. So maybe the first on the whole enlargement issue, and of course I have to be eternally grateful to my friend from Serbia, even that he mentions Turkey, but anyway. I don't think enlargement is imminent at this point, the last thing that people want to hear about at this point, I think. But there is the whole issue of neighborhood, Ukraine, Balkans. I don't think we have time to get into the Turkish question, although Peter is one of the world specialists of that. But how will all this affect enlargement, the whole enlargement debate? And is it just kind of dead, or is there some hope? Who would like to deal with that? Isabel?
Well, I'll deal with only a tiny fraction of it. But some of the accession is already underway, and I think that machinery is already in motion. So if I'm correct, I think it's Serbia and Montenegro who are in the wings to join. But it's the other states who are waiting, who've signed these kind of pre-agreements, who are the ones I think are going to have to wait a long time. When I've spoken to people in the European institutions, they've just said, well, no, that at the moment there is enlargement fatigue and you can't really expect another wave following the Serbia and Montenegro joining. There will be a while before that happens again. Mostly, I think, because of Pete's concern over the economy, the freedom of movement. A lot of the arguments that Britain has thrown up following Romania and Bulgaria joining and coming to Europe, capping a certain amount of internal immigration. So I think those issues will have to be resolved to some degree and there to be a slightly more open debate before that enlargement process will continue as it has done in the past. That's my take on that.
Thank you. Peter, any views, including on the Ukraine? To what extent does the Ukraine crisis, call for and how to what extent has it increased the kind of pressure to have a more cohesive also European foreign policy and security policy?
I think the enlargement agenda is still there. There are some candidates, as you say, Isabel, in the pipeline. There are others waiting a bit longer. There's Turkey, who's been a little bit leapfrogged, unfortunately, by others who have perhaps moved a bit more rapidly in that direction. We take the view that enlargement has actually been one of the great foreign policy and even democracy-building successes of the European Union. Look how it has consolidated the gains for freedom of speech and open market economics and democracy in countries which were once part of the Warsaw Pact. So we still think that it's the right direction of travel. It will perhaps take a bit of a pause at the moment. I think we all knew there was going to be a bit of a pause after the last very large wave of enlargement. Some of the concerns which people have expressed about immigration, about free movement of labor, population, I think have been, I won't say discounted, but were perhaps exaggerated. We have all heard over many, many years that there are great fears that if you bring in a relatively poor member state, that the economies of the more prosperous ones are going to be flooded with people seeking better paid jobs. it's usually been an exaggerated fear. Sometimes there's been a bit of that at the beginning, but then as membership tends to lead salary levels and economies to rise to meet something resembling a European average, if you like, all boats rise, then people have been quite often happy to go back to their own economies. And I think some of those fears have been exaggerated. That's something that Tony Blair, who is a great European, if you like, in British politics, has been saying in a speech earlier today, that let's not get over-concerned about that. So I think moving ahead with enlargement is something which we would certainly favour, of course, provided the relative member state candidates meet the criteria for membership. We're not going to be able to break the rules or anything else, and nobody is suggesting that. Does the Ukraine crisis change that? Well, Ukraine is sui generis. You know, we have to deal with the whole issue of Ukraine's ability to choose its own future, what direction it wants to take. There's been endless talk about whether Ukraine should or shouldn't be allowed to apply for NATO membership, and what happens with the European Union and the association agreement documents. I think Ukraine is a case a bit apart and needs to be dealt with particular sensitivity. Are we going to see more CFSP and so on? Well, I think that depends really on the nature of the crises that we have to address. I like to think that the European Union, in partnership with the United States, has made a pretty decent job when you consider what we were dealing with and the pace at which we were having to deal with it of handling the Ukraine crisis. I like to think, perhaps I'm being a little naive, that the worst may be behind us, but nothing can be taken for granted. But I think the response of the United States, European Union collectively, successive European councils to the Ukraine crisis has shown that the European Union can do its job and can make a stand on very important issues and produce a pretty much united view even when there are different levels of economic integration and dependence on oil and gas from Russia and all the other complex issues which were part of it. But I think it's been a reminder that we do need to have an effective common foreign security policy. Cathy Ashton and her team have been deeply involved in that. They are deeply involved in dealing with the Iran issue, trying to ensure that we have a negotiated end to the question of whether or not the Iranians are going to have nuclear military weapons, which we do not wish, and that is a key part of CFSP. I think it will be moving forward in that direction as and when international crises require it. The European Union on its own has not, but then nor has anybody else, been able to make much of an impact, alas, on things like Syria and the difficulties there. And there are other countries in that part of the world, in the Middle East and beyond, which clearly need a great deal of support from European member states. But I think that will remain a high priority for our heads of government. Not sure that it will mean a sudden dramatic acceleration in this part of EU activity. I suspect that what's going to happen in the coming months is that we deal with these institutional issues, we deal with the search for the top jobs, who's going to get what slot, and so on. We continue to try to consolidate the fragile economic recovery, which we're all now beginning to witness, and dealing with the applications in the pipeline that are already there from candidate countries, rather than rushing off seeking additional challenges, except where there is no response, there is no choice but to try to respond to a new crisis.
Yeah, I mean, maybe just one point, that to me was surprising, is maybe not that well known, and any quick reaction to that. But there seemed to be quite a strong kind of interaction links, some degree of support between Vladimir Putin's Moscow and some of the extreme Eurosceptic parties. The head of the Bulgarian Ataka party launched his campaign from Moscow with some very devastating statements about Romas and very racist statements. Marine Le Pen and others, I think.
Nigel Farage.
Nigel Farage too expressed admiration and for Putin and so on. So there is something somewhat new, of course, in the old days when the Soviet Union was supporting the communist parties in Europe, there was something similar. But do you see any kind of Russian-backed extremism?
I think that's highly improbable because I could not think of having any extensive appeal within the European Union. You always have, and particularly in the course of an election campaign, you have some highly erratic, unpredictable, regrettable aspects. But I really don't think that there is the the space in within the European Union for that to take off in any significant or meaningful way.
Reza, in terms of Doug Rediger's question and anything else you may want to address, but particularly this issue that, you know, monetary policy almost by nature requires a market for a deep risk-free asset. And
let me
so what answer, is what, you know,
let me answer that question, and if I may, I'll come back to Eastern Europe and okay. enlargement also. It is interesting in terms of progress in Europe. The term banking union did not exist 3 years ago. We used it in the first time in our Euro consultation in 2012, and it's amazing how far things have moved on that front. And in terms of banking union, we have always talked about three strands of it: a single supervisor, a single resolution, and some form of risk-sharing common backstop. And I think on the first of those, there's clearly been progress. I mean, faster than people have expected, ECB is going to be a single supervisor, and the process for that is well underway. I think on single resolution, there's been progress, but perhaps not as much and not as deep as some like us have been advocating. But there is some progress, and that probably where there is least progress is in terms of backstop and risk sharing. And that is where interest of the union and what is politically acceptable nationally becomes in conflict. And that one of those strands is precisely what you mentioned, is the link between sovereign and the banks. Now, that link is very troublesome during times of stress. And, of course, those times of stress have passed, and so the urgency viewed, despite the declaration in June 2012 of breaking that link, there has been some progress, but not sufficient progress. If there is a recurrence of stress, I think that is a problem. In terms of what you mentioned, whether sovereign paper is risk-free or not, if you ask any sovereign, of course they will tell you it is risk-free. But a supervisor like the ECB that looks at balance sheets of banks, when they stress that balance sheet, it is perfectly legitimate for them to make assumptions about what if that paper is under stress and not valued as risk-free. So it is understandable that the ECB would use that in there. Let me come back in terms of Eastern Europe. I think when the dust settles, everyone will realize that enlargement has been in the interest of both the new member states and the existing members. Take the case of Poland and Ukraine. You mentioned Ukraine. They started at the same level of income post the fall of Berlin Wall, and we know where Poland is and we know where Ukraine is now, vastly apart. A difference has been, of course, the European process of integration has generated democratic reform, but also major economic reform. And it has also been in the benefit of the core of Europe. The German supply chain runs through Poland, and the German competitiveness is enhanced by what Poland has to offer. So I think now, is it going to be more difficult moving forward? Some of the countries which are potential member states have a long way to go in terms of reforms. So just by that nature, it will be more difficult. But let us not forget, in the middle of the crisis, the Eurozone expanded. They brought Latvia into the Eurozone. It is consideration of Lithuania now coming into the zone, which looks like it would be successful. So I very much hope that the momentum for integration, whether it's within the Eurozone itself or the greater European Union, will continue.
Thank you. Jacques, do you see some kind of mutualized European debt, Eurobond, next 5 years or not?
Well, I very well understand that Germany did not want to hear anything about Eurobonds. The Germany went out of the story of rescuing the German Democratic Republic. They were not willing to do the same with the whole set of southern countries. So for me, I always said to my French counterparts that it was bad suggestion to make that as a discussion point with Germany. Now, Germany, in my view, has got a large part, not the totality, but a large part of what it could expected in order to improve the fiscal governance of the Eurozone. It's not perfect, and in particular, I support what Reza said previously about the differentiation of fiscal targets between different countries. But it had got a lot of things, and at one moment of time in the future, the question will be raised again, and at that moment of time, the question of the Eurobonds will be raised again, and at that moment, it will be more difficult for Germany to say, we definitely don't want, even in a better fiscal framework, to be integrated in this sort of Eurobond market. That would help also what Reza suggested, the creation of a unified and liquid capital market in Europe. I am not negative on that, only for one reason, because traveling frequently to Berlin, I know that the Germans, who were at the beginning extremely reluctant to seize the full complexity of the Eurozone crisis, have done their homework in an incredible manner, much better than the French, for example. And just on that point, I remember that the first operational proposal regarding the Eurobond scheme came from Germany, the Council of Economic Advisers, no less. So I think that sometimes in the visible future, this could come back to the table.
And you wanted to say yes?
Yes, because I just made a quick answer to your question there in parenthesis. But I did want to say just a word about enlargement. Not that I disagree with any of the words of the colleagues, but I just think, you know, we shouldn't be allow ourselves to be kind of gripped in the fearfulness of the vision of, or lack of vision, of what, after all, are a very small minority. I mean, the most glorious day in Europe practically was 2004 when we enlarged to the, brought in the 10 new member states. And for once, we were rising above the small print that we're always stuck in Brussels. And we had this vision of a Europe whole and free, and we celebrated it across Europe. And for our young people, I think, who aren't necessarily trapped in the same fears of some of the older people about immigration and job loss and so on, for them, it's a rationale and a vision for Europe that makes sense. So yes to the caution and the carefulness and all of that, but if Europe essentially has to be communicated as a vision, as something to believe in, don't let us ever forget that this goes to the heart of what Europe is about and what we can believe in.
Thank you very much, Anne, for this very eloquent statement. On the macroeconomics, let me just state some numbers. I'm not quite sure of the UK one, but you know, it's kind of interesting that the US has an unemployment rate a little bit above 6% and a current account deficit in the balance of payments of about $350 billion. 12 months. The Eurozone has an unemployment rate close on average, but of course there's these huge differences, of close to 13%, but a surplus that has now reached $320 billion. So it's a little bit strange to have such a huge unemployment with such a huge current account surplus. You would think that there's some space here for expansion. China, who knows what the unemployment rate is, but the current account surplus has shrunk quite a bit, below $200 billion. The UK, the current account deficit, I think, is now about $110 billion, which is very large. And the unemployment rate, if I'm not mistaken, is around 6.5?
6.5.
And Japan has a current account that is more or less in balance now, unless I'm wrong, Reza, roughly, and an unemployment rate of about 6. So it's kind of interesting to keep that in mind, but I find the Eurozone number particularly interesting because, you know, and this surplus is growing, not shrinking. Anyway, that's just an aside. Now, what I would suggest is that we keep Miriam's question for the end, for the last round, because it's the question of what constructively can be done to resolve the, you know, the kind of institutional issue, and then you can add whatever else. But maybe before we do that, we take one or two more questions. There was this young gentleman here that had asked, and then you later, and then, and then we just have time for three. Or maybe we'll see how quick they are.
Hi, Brett Fortnum from Inside U.S. Trade. In light of the recent EU parliamentary elections, there's been a growing concern about how TTIP is going to proceed. And Ms. Anderson, you mentioned that there are going to be some short-term complications. I was wondering if you could expound upon that a little bit.
And short-term?
Yes.
Short-term costs.
Complications.
No. Short-term
complications.
Complications, okay. Yes. And there's also a talk about a turnaround in market sentiments, I would like to know if those would have any lasting effects on the direction of the negotiations.
Okay. Yes? As quickly and concise as possible. Thank you.
Hans-Roger AVB. The question from Monsieur Mistral and Monsieur Mogadam. It's in regard to legitimacy and the question of debt. Debt is a false choice, and I'm quoting Robert Rubin. The question is the quality of the debt. The academic literature, and Mr. Dervish, I apologize, the academic literature is not conclusive on the correlation between debt and growth. If we wish to cite Ken Rogoff and Carmen Reinhardt's paper or work, unfortunately, the data just doesn't add up. It goes to the question of Lord Turner's argument, which was, we have to look at the quality of the debt. What is the debt used for? What are the maturity implications? 2002, 2005, France and Germany both break the stability pact. But Germany finances, and I will be brief, Germany uses the money, if you will, the debt, to finance the Schröder's reforms. France uses the money to consume. So the question, if you don't mind, Monsieur Mogadam, is how do we reconcile the obligation to provide, you know, support to those economies? We have two frameworks, 1790 in America, Alexander Hamilton, the report to the Congress, and yes, in London, 1953, the German external debt, 50% written off. And Monsieur Mistral, to just finish on that point, the question of legitimacy, 1992 at La Sorbonne, the debate between Monsieur Segan and François Mitterrand. The week before, the polls were, in fact, 54 for the non and close to 43, and someone decided for the oui. The oui won, but a very, very tiny margin. And then in 2005, which is where I'm going to finish, in 2005, it was a resounding no to the question of the Constitution. What did we have? We had a Traité de Lisbonne. So in Paris today, you have people who tell you, we said no, we were not listened to, and hence, Madame Le Pen. Thank you.
Right. Last question over there. Yes. Sorry. No, sorry. Well, okay, we'll, yeah. But you have to be very quick, huh? Okay? In the back there.
Ajay Chopra from Peterson Institute. People have talked very positively about Eastern Europe, but there's a bit of a paradox here because the participation rates in Eastern Europe were among the worst. Slovakia was just in the teens. So it'd be interesting to get perspectives on what's happening here. Are they disenchanted with just European institutions?
Yeah, and then the gentleman in the very end, very brief, please, thank you very much. And please identify yourself.
Hello, my name is Michael Burnside. I have a bit of a strange question. It involves a definition of the word job. So in this country, historically, my grandfather and his father's time period, a job was 6 days out of seven and 10 hours a day. In my father's and my time, it's obviously 5 days and 8 hours a day. As an American, it's been interesting watching Europe. I think France for a while had a 35-hour work week, and I think Sweden just recently has asked part of its civil service to do a 6-hour day. In stability in politics, it's important for young people to have work. Is there any hope of redefining this word job that we throw around so easily?
Thank you. Very interesting question, actually, but limited time. So what we'll do now is we'll have a last round. Please do address some of the last questions. We can't take any more questions, unfortunately. But also give your view or answer to Miriam's question of, you know, briefly, of course. And Anne, you're free to leave whenever you have to catch your plane.
Okay.
So maybe what we'll do is we'll start with you so that you have the chance of leaving if you have to.
Okay, thank you.
And then Isabel, Jacques, Reza, and Peter.
All right, I won't try to, for reasons of time and because others have greater expertise on some of these, I won't try to answer all the questions. TTIP, because I think there was something addressed to me on that. I really wanted to send a positive, forward-looking message on TTIP, and I said in passing that there may be some blips, if you like. What I meant by that was it's going to take time for things to settle down in the European Parliament with this 30% of the Eurosceptics, etc. We may see some debate and discussion from them about the wisdom of TTIP, because a lot of these people are concerned about globalization and so on. There will need to be reassurance, discussion and so on. But I didn't mean to suggest anything that would slow the momentum of TTIP in any significant way, because I think it truly has to move forward. On some of the other, I'd love to discourse on job and work and so on. I won't. Our young people, you know, they need to be doing something worthwhile that's going to give them a living wage. And, you know, I think that's how they see it. Disappointing, of course, to see those very low turnout rates in countries like Slovakia in particular, and how to enthuse and engage them is a huge question. On Miriam's question, it's obviously, in retrospect, I would think it unfortunate that we have this ambiguity in the Lisbon Treaty, because it allows both sides, as you say, to claim it's, you know, it's my way and my way, and give their own interpretations in the face of this ambiguity. I really hope and believe that it will be resolved in a mature way. The president of the European Council, President Van Rompuy, he has been tasked to take it forward, to make soundings. He hasn't been given a deadline, but I think it's generally understood people want him to proceed in an expeditious way, because I think everybody understands to have this open-ended discussion, it's just going to drag us down if it goes on too long. So, yes, it needs to be addressed seriously, and a bit of time needs to be allowed for that, but I don't think anyone is thinking of this dragging on for months and months. As to how they address it constructively, I mean, don't forget, of course, we shouldn't forget there are three jobs in this package, three big jobs, jobs as members of the Commission as well. But the normal thing that mature people do, I will hope, as I said at the beginning, that in the light of the election results, they relook at the qualities that are required, look at the individuals, look at the three jobs, and see what is a mature way forward that's good for Europe. That's how I hope it'll play out. And I really do, but I mean, my Prime Minister has chosen his can. I'm leaving all that sort of thing aside. But I think, and I've seen this happen in Europe, that yes, people articulate their views and it's fought out. But in the end of the day, I think there will be a maturity and a coming together in the interests of Europe going forward. Thank you.
Thank you. You said something very important, Anne, and I just want to stress it one more time. That a lot of what we're debating is way beyond Europe, I think, is, you know, really how to manage globalization and international cooperation and global public goods, whether it's trade or climate. President Obama has taken a major initiative on power plant standards this week. I was with Nick Stern just last week. You know, all the evidence is that the climate change threat is, if anything, more serious than people thought. It may not be an immediate threat for tomorrow, but, you know, for the next 10, 20 years, something very serious has to be done. But all this needs some kind of global cooperation and action. I think that's what you stressed.
Yeah.
In a sense, Europe is a kind of experiment in post-World War II transnational cooperation. And if it fails, it will have tremendously negative impact everywhere else. I just wanted to add, we're debating Europe today, but we're debating also on how to manage, you know, the 21st century interdependencies, and I think that's very, very important, and Anne stressed it very forcefully in the beginning. And I don't think the answers are at all easy, because, you know, who said it? The U.S. Paul, what was his name again? O'Neill. All politics is local.
Tip O'Neill.
And it's true, you know, all politics is tremendously local, and yet there are many problems that have to be addressed globally. So, Isabel,
so,
what are your last words of wisdom and of encouragement?
Wisdom, I'm not sure, but I shall. Just in terms of the TTIP, something that wasn't mentioned is the fact that in Europe there is a real kind of skepticism towards TTIP, and I think that, as you were mentioning, might well be played out in the Parliament, because the Greens aren't very for TTIP. They're not really backing it in its state at the moment, and they're asking for more open discussion about it. They don't like the fact that it's being held in closed doors. Martin Schulz has also spoken about his scepticism towards the TTIP negotiations. So though I think it will probably go ahead, there is concern in Europe that Europe will be a loser in that. So I think that needs to be presented to Europeans more clearly, because at the moment they think, you know, it's going to be win-win for the US, probably just win for Europe. In terms of Eastern Europe and its poor participation rate, in fact, yes, Slovakia, the participation rate was 13%, which was the lowest in the election. I suppose one of the reasons for that is if you look at a lot of the countries in Eastern Europe, maybe they're not feeling the benefits of the EU yet. Romania still is one of the poorest, I think it's the poorest member of the EU. So that is going to have to change before they probably feel fully-fledged members of the EU. And Romania and Bulgaria have had a lot of backlash as well. They've not been made to feel particularly welcome by Britain and UKIP, for example. So there are these factors. I think that there's probably a certain amount of disenchantment with the EU at that level. In terms of the candidate, that's the exciting bit. Well, I suppose we all know that Angela Merkel's the one who's in the driving seat here, and she's found herself between a rock and a hard place, because whichever decision she makes, it seems, is not going to really have necessarily a positive outcome. If she backs Juncker, which does seem what she's doing, but she does seem to be, she's had a vote fast recently, but she does back Juncker, well, that's going to cause problems, obviously, with David Cameron, who's trying to form a blocking minority who might be able to rally enough people to block that if that does push through. And I think it was Juncker who said that David Cameron was blackmailing Europe over the fact that it might force a British exit from Europe. Angela Merkel certainly won't want to be the chancellor who was in power when Britain left Europe and, you know, was one of the driving forces forcing a disintegration of Europe. So whatever happens, it's going to be very difficult. Daniel Cohn-Bendit, who's very influential in the European Parliament, he was one of the leaders of the Greens, said that if Jean-Claude Juncker doesn't become the president of the European Commission, the Council better beware, because the Parliament will become a nuclearly explosive site for them, and not, you know, that they can't expect any cooperation from the Parliament. So there will be a clash of the institutions, despite the fact that Herman Van Rompuy, who's the president of the Council, says he'll try and avoid that. I think it's probably an inevitability. So the constructive part, possibly a super candidate. I don't know. We talked about the possibility of Christine Lagarde. My colleagues here don't think it's necessarily, you know, it could possibly wouldn't happen, but I think she might be one of the super candidates who could override all these discussions.
And Pascal Lamy?
Pascal Lamy maybe doesn't have that same super candidate status, but he could be a very good commission president.
All right. See, we're getting into new speculations here. Jacques, last first, word of wisdom.
First, about legitimacy and Marine Le Pen, I would say two things. First of all, democracy, you have one vote more than the half. You have 51%. That makes the decision, and it's perfect legitimacy, and it has been confirmed since then. And regarding Marine Le Pen, I would love that no one excessively emphasizes the size of the success. The Front National this time has 4.8 million voters, and Marine Le Pen 2 years ago had 6.4. So it's not an explosion of the extreme right vote.
You mean at the presidentials?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So every voter who was willing to vote Front National had an opportunity this time. They are less than. So don't overemphasize that that were very idiosyncratic situation. TTIP, when faced with a difficult situation, I came back from my stay in this city during 6 years. by using American comparisons. So the question is, TTIP is a difficult legislative process. I would say that it will not be more difficult with the new parliament than it is with Congress. Jobs, redefining working hours. Well, personally, I'm quite comfortable, and I think that Kemal will not say the contrary. I worked for Prime Minister Michel Rocard, who was strongly in favor of measures reducing the working time. It would have done that in a better way than what has been done with the 35 hours. But this is in my political genes. And I suppose with Kemal, that this could be part of a new far-reaching social contract in Europe. Finally, regarding the president, I share most of the views of Isabel. The parliament is empowered now to veto or to accept the proposal of the council. So the council definitely doesn't nominate the president of the commission. His candidate has to be approved by the parliament. I share the view of the of Anne, the Irish ambassador, that the heads of government certainly want this issue to be resolved relatively rapidly. The problem is that they have cornered themselves. They have said two things. First, the head of the Spitzenkandidaten will be the natural candidates for the job. And second, we want to keep the flexibility to nominate the president. These are contradictory. And this was the contradiction in which Mrs. Merkel was taken last week, saying on Tuesday, well, I don't know exactly, and saying on Friday, well, I have been committed to support Mrs. Juncker, and in every meeting now on, I will support Mr. Juncker. So it's not a personal question. It's really an institutional question, and a new electoral body like the parliament will not cede this the exercise of this new power. A different, a super candidate, I don't believe. I always am happy to see French people in a position to be candidates like that, but I think that the parliament has no reason to accept anyone coming outside from his electoral results. So neither Mrs. Lagarde nor Pascal Lamy, I think, they are excellent candidates, both of them, naturally, promised to higher positions among international institutions. I'm not sure that the best job for them is head of the commission.
Reza.
Let me answer the debt question and also touch on the jobs question. On the debt, there are two separate issues. There's sustainability, where it really depends on ability of the country to finance its debt and the markets to accept that debt. And that could be different levels. Japan has very high debt, but it can finance it. Other countries get into trouble with much lower level of debt. So sustainability is one issue. The impact on growth is another issue. It is, I think, if you look at a correlation of investment and debt, you see that high debt leads to lower investment, hence lower growth. If you look at correlation of consumption and debt, when debt is high, consumers don't spend, so spending is low, growth is lower. So it is, I think, very clear-cut, and we have done a lot of work on this across countries. When debt is high, it reduces investment, which is a major problem right now in Europe. Investment levels are way, way below pre-crisis, and therefore it weighs on growth. So in that sense, addressing the debt issue is important, but it is for growth, but that's a separate issue. But from
President, just to clarify, when the old theory was saying when the debt was high, interest rates would be high, right? And that would depress investment. Now investment seems to be depressed despite, except in crisis countries, record low interest rates.
But when your balance sheet is encumbered, If you have a very high debt, then even at low interest rates, you may be concerned that you will not be able to, say, be a profitable enterprise, and therefore you will not be investing. Or as a consumer, particularly when you look at the demographics in Europe, you may be concerned about your pension, your ability to consume later, and therefore withhold consumption in the short run. So I think there's a very clear relationship between growth and debt if you break it down in different dimensions also. On the jobs, I think what the questioner asked is very important. I think the issue is not a standard job that people define. The world is changing. One may work for 15 hours, or one may work for 30 hours, one may work for much longer. The issue is flexibility to do that and the regulations that govern that. And the problem in Europe is that that flexibility, both in terms of cost and regulation when it comes to contracts, are too rigid. And so you need to have that more flexible. And, of course, it's difficult to do that when that protection and the cost of labor has been very high. Liberalizing that, of course, is difficult, but you need that in order to create jobs. But what you also need at the same time, and Europe is good at that, is social protection. So protecting the worker, not the position in a particular place.
Reza, as director of the IMF Europe Department, I will not ask you about your views on the super candidate.
Thank you.
Peter.
Thank you, Kemal. A couple of points on those questions. On the labour and the jobs, and what is a job as opposed to top jobs, I'll come to that in a moment. Obviously, what Europe needs is to have a properly flexible definition of a labour market, which allows for a whole lot of changes in the way people live their lives. Even in my organisation, the British Foreign Office, we see submissions signed off by two people who are joint heads of department. They do 3 days a week or 2.5 days each as this job. I have people who take 80% of the pay and do 4 days rather than 5 days work during the week. We are moving in the direction of trying to adapt in a flexible way to what different individuals want to do and how much of their life they wish to spend earning a job. And we're doing this partly because I think it's right to be flexible, but it's also a key to diversity. If we're not going to be flexible in terms of our employment practices, we're not going to be able to attract all the talent that we want when people have got other requirements in their lives. I think it's fundamental. It's about regulation and it's about labour markets, but it's also about a culture of being more adaptable in terms of those of us who are the employers. Second point I would make, and you're probably going to make me answer the Scotland question because I'm not sure who else is qualified to do it, but I'm not sure that I am either, but that's another matter. How are we going to advance on the selection of these key positions? Yes, we want to do this with maturity, with haste, with dignity. We want to get some answers on a consensual basis. That's for sure. Let's not forget what the treaty says. The treaty says that it is for the council, for the heads of government between themselves, if necessary voting by a qualified majority, to nominate a candidate who is then voted upon by the European Parliament. It's not for the European Parliament to tell the council who it wants. It is the other way around. And so people who've come through, Spitzenkandidaten or whatever they want to be, that's fine. They're out there. They are amongst the candidates who've been presented. But I didn't see the name of either Mr. Juncker or Mr. Schulz or anybody else on any of the ballot papers that were voted upon by electors in any countries other than their own countries where they were candidates for membership of the European Parliament. So I think we need to be clear what the rules are, what the treaty says, and then the heads of government will need to work out amongst themselves. That's why a rather sensible decision seems to be asking Herman Van Rompuy to go away, talk to the candidates, see what the options are, and come back with some proposals for the heads of government to look at collectively, and hopefully we will then end up with some answers. But absolutely right, others have said it's not just one job, the President of the Commission. We've also got the President of the Council. We've also got the High Rep and the Vice President of the Commission, the job held by Cathy Ashton, and we've got all the other key jobs, members of the Commission, and hopefully within the coming months we will all be able to find ourselves in a position where everybody's content with the outcomes. I will refrain from commenting on the names that we mentioned other than to say that there are undoubtedly some outstandingly good French candidates whose name could be in the ring, but there are plenty of other candidates as well, and I'll not go further than that. And then what about Scotland independence? What would that mean? Well, there will be a referendum in the United Kingdom, actually not in the United Kingdom, in Scotland only, on the 18th of September, which is not very far away, when people who live in Scotland, not Scots abroad, not English, not Welsh, not Northern Irish, and members of the United Kingdom, but those people who live in Scotland above the age of 16 will be invited to vote on whether or not Scotland will become independent and separate itself from the United Kingdom, an arrangement which has been intact for the last 300 years. This is a pretty big deal, actually, for my country, and a lot of us are concerned about what the implications might be. My government has facilitated the holding of that referendum as a result of the election of a Scottish Nationalist majority in the local elections last time around in Scotland in 2011, but the British government is not actually neutral on the issue. The British government, and not only the parties in government, but also the principal opposition parties, actually take the view that we would like the United Kingdom to stay together. And that's why you will hear Scottish, but also English and Welsh and other members of Parliament, political figures, business figures in the UK, expressing an opinion as to whether they do or do not want Scotland to become independent. If it did become independent, if there is a majority in favour of independence on the 18th of September, then that is what will happen. And we will all have to scurry around and make a whole lot of changes to an awful lot of things and the ways in which the United Kingdom conducts its business. One of many questions that arises, and there are lots, about currency, about foreign investment, about defence, about NATO commitments, all sorts of different things that are out there, about pension rights, about the share of the sovereign debt of the United Kingdom, which would arise for an independent Scotland. But there is also the question of European Union membership. I think Mr. Salmond, who is the First Minister of Scotland, has said that he expects there to be a seamless transition to Scottish membership of the European Union. That is not what leaders of the European Union have said. Other political leaders in the European Union have said that if Scotland leaves the United Kingdom and wants to join the European Union, it'll have to take its place in the queue. It will have to apply like every other candidate country, and it will require the unanimous consent of every single one of the 28 members of the EU. I'd be surprised if all that got done and the entire accession process completed seamlessly in 18 months, but we will see. And it is clear that there are some member states which are quite nervous about the idea of a member state fragmenting and then bits of a member state reapplying for membership of the European Union. But it is one of a number of quite complex questions that would arise in the event that there is a vote in favour of independence in September.
Thank you very much, Peter. And let me just add a few words, and then we'll close. I think some of what we've debated, as Anne started off with, really has to do with global the way you cooperate in a global economy, in a global world. The cooperation between nation states is, of course, still the main way one cooperates. And the nation state is not about to go away, even within Europe, as we see. And I think it also still is a source of a lot of democratic legitimacy because of the feeling of belonging, of identity, of the democratic mechanism within a nation state. But I do believe, and I think we had examples of that today, and we'll have other examples, that many issues do require a degree of cooperation between nation states and a degree of kind of global citizenship. Or regional citizenship in Africa, for example. Africa could do much, much better if there was a much further degree of, much more integration in Africa. So there is that issue, and I think we're struggling with it. Today the debate was struggling with it. In my own experience, let me just share one thing. How a person gets a particular job that is supranational, and of course the Commission is a much more political, as Jacques said, organization than the IMF or the World Bank is, for example. Okay, but to some degree, there are some they're bureaucracies that try to solve economic problems, that try to manage international or global cooperation, and so on. And there has to be a certain amount of legitimacy in these bureaucracies, which very often then have to be kind of personalized, because in politics and in global civics, in media, things get very personalized with the person, he or she, who is heading these organizations. So I think to view the appointments as purely technocratic, whether it's the Commission or heading the IMF, the World Bank, the WTO, is no longer appropriate for today's world. There have been figures, such as Jacques Delors, who, you know, was a technician and was not a political leader as head of the commission, but at the same time had a direct message to citizens and was accepted as such by citizens. And there are other examples one can give, from other international institutions. I many years ago, you know, you would not, I don't want to go into current examples because, you know, it's kind of controversial, but despite the problems of the Vietnam War and so on, when McNamara was head of the World Bank, you know, he was addressing global citizenship, so to speak, as head of the World Bank. And there have been leaders of the IMF that have done similarly. So I think that element is important. And to somehow view global cooperation as purely a matter of national diplomacies cooperating and working together, I think underestimates the degree of need there is for a global or regional demos, in a way. But, of course, we are very far from having achieved it yet. Thank you so much for coming, all of you, and thank particularly, of course, the panel, the wonderful panel we've had. I hope you've enjoyed this. I hope Brookings is fulfilling its mission of bringing such discussions together. And please give a round of applause to our panelists.